Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a resident. This is episode 213 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'll be continuing the Family Medicine Shelf Review Series. This will be series 4. And I think in this particular episode, I'm going to be finishing my GI coverage of what's classically tested on the Family Medicine Shelf Exam. And again, my apologies. I know I haven't made a podcast in about 13 days. That's actually pretty abysmal. And my apologies for that. It's just I've been extremely busy and I also have not been feeling very well for the past couple of days. So my apologies. But hopefully that should change since things are kind of back on track at this point. So let's just jump right into it, right? So what if you get a question about a patient that, has difficulty swallowing and this person has lost weight, right? What would you recommend next to that person? I would really hope that you're thinking about getting an EGD, right? So you may see you may see the answer EGD, or you may see it stated as esophageal gastroduodenoscopy on your test, or you may see it referred to as upper endoscopy, right? That's what you want to do. The thing is, basically, you may say, okay, Divine, like, when do I do like EGDs when a person has dysphagia? Well, let me just kind of give you some big ones, right? So some big ones you want to keep at the back of your mind. If a person, you know, has lost weight, you're obviously kind of worried about cancer at that point. If a person has like really like painful swallowing, so like odynophagia, you'd also want to consider getting an EGD at that point. Or if a person, you know, you've tried like almost what I would call maximum medical therapy, and they do not appear to be getting better, that's kind of a worrisome sign as well, right? You'd also want to do an EGD under those circumstances, right? So let's say, for example, you know, a person has had GERD, you've put them on a PPI, you've up-titrated the dose and all that stuff. You've done it for like many weeks, usually more than 6 weeks. They're not getting better. Yeah, you probably want to go ahead and do an EGD under those circumstances, right? But here is one sneaky one that your friends at the MBME have started, you know, putting a lot more stock in recent times, actually, right? And that's actually this concept of a being over the age of 50. If a person has dysphagia and they're over the age of 50, basically, being over the age of 50 is an alarm symptom. Whenever you see that on your exam, you need to very strongly consider getting an EGD under those circumstances. So that's just one of those ones people don't think too hard about, right? So it's just something you want to keep in mind for your test, right? And then if they give you a question about a person, you know, that has trouble like initiating swallowing, right? You want to think about that person having more of like an oropharyngeal dysphagia than an esophageal dysphagia, right? So if, for example, you see a person that, you know, has like nasal regurgitation of food, or the person has like trouble like just initiating swallowing, right? In general, you want to consider thinking more about like an oropharyngeal cause of dysphagia versus like an esophageal cause of their dysphagia, right? And usually these people that have like oropharyngeal dysphagia like problems, they are almost always people that have like some kind of weird neuromuscular disease like Parkinson's, or they have like ALS or myasthenia gravis, right? Or like, you know, like they can make it a kid, because again, remember, your family medicine shelf can include questions on kids, right? So don't think, ooh, internal medicine, we don't do anything past the age of 18. No, that's essentially not the case for family medicine. Family medicine, you're going to see kids, right? So kids are going to be on your test, right? So a kid with muscular dystrophy, right, can certainly have this kind of oropharyngeal dysphagia on your test. And in general, if a person has oropharyngeal dysphagia, right, one reason your friends at the MBME like this is you do a different kind of test to initially evaluate those people, right? So you do something called video fluoroscopy, right, where you essentially like do like a barium swallow, but you take like almost like cine, like that's a radiology term. Just think of it as you're doing like a video recording of them swallowing. Let's leave it at that, okay? The buzzword you're looking for in your test is video fluoroscopy, right? And then if they give you a question about like an old guy, you know, has like regurgitation of undigested food, has like really smelly mouth, like let's say his spouse like complains that, honey, your mouth smells like a ton in the morning, right? You know, think about Zenker's diverticulum, and the person will also have again trouble swallowing, right? So think about Zenker's diverticulum. Basically, if they ask about the pathophysiology for whatever bizarre reason on your family medicine shelf, just pick the answer that relates to the cricopharyngeal muscle. You know, like just cricopharyngeal muscle crap that's going on is essentially the pathophysiology behind the Zenker's diverticulum, right? And again, they almost always have halitosis, right? Like just very, very smelly mouths in the morning, right? So just something to keep at the back of your mind, right? And then if a person has dysphagia for like solids and liquids, right, you want to think more along the lines of, again, like a motility disorder, like achalasia, right? Achalasia is actually an esophageal motility disorder. People don't really think much about it, but achalasia is not, because many people think, oh, it's just, you know, increased tone, lower esophageal sphincter. The thing is, people that also have achalasia also have like decreased peristalsis of the esophagus, right? So that's something you want to commit to memory. And remember, achalasia, right? Classic appearance, bird's beak pattern on imaging, right? And people that have achalasia, right? You want to think about first getting a barium swallow, right? That's where you see the bird beak sign. And then after that, you do like esophageal manometry, right? So think about it, right? It wouldn't make sense to get esophageal manometry if you do not suspect that this person has like a motility thing going on, right? So you get esophageal manometry, and then after that, you do an EGD before you then take those people to surgery, right? And the EGD, right, is to rule out pseudoachalasia, because sometimes what may look like achalasia on barium swallow is actually esophageal cancer, right? Because remember, achalasia is actually a risk factor for squamous cell cancer of the esophagus, right? So you typically want to make sure that, you know, you just kind of make sure this person doesn't have like an actual raging malignancy going on before you take them to surgery, right? And remember that achalasia can be caused by things like Chagas disease, right? So from like Trypanosoma cruzii. And in general, for achalasia, right, you want to do like the you maybe want to try to avoid like, you know, like a pneumatic dilation, right? Because if you do a pneumatic dilation, you can perf the patient's esophagus and, you know, you'll have a whole new set of problems on your hands, right? So in general, for achalasia, right, like you try not to do that. I mean, there are some drugs that they may ask you about on your test, right? On your test, the some things you can do is you can give dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker that can help with dilating the lower esophageal sphincter. You can inject Botox every few months. That also works. But pneumatic dilation, they typically test pneumatic dilation in the context of the complication, which is perforating the esophagus, right? And the thing is, sometimes, remember I said that, oh, Chagas disease can be a cause of achalasia. The thing is, basically, one way they can introduce that on your test is they can talk about a person that comes into clinic, has been having dysphagia for a couple of months, and the person, you know, like 6 months ago or whatever, traveled to South America. If you see that, you really want to think about T. cruzii as the potential cause of the achalasia, right? And again, achalasia, do not do EGD first. I promise you, if you pick EGD as your first diagnostic test, you're going to get the question wrong, right? For achalasia, the first thing you're doing is a barium swallow. After the barium swallow, you do the manometry. After the manometry, then do the EGD, right? Just remember, biomedical engineering, BME, right? That's the order. Barium swallow first, manometry second, and then EGD next, right? And again, don't forget your bird's beak sign, right? And then if a person comes in with like, you know, like heartburn, and they tell you that, oh, they have like this cough that's worse when they get up in the morning, because, you know, if you're sleeping, right, you're like in a kind of like a supine position, so you know that acid can kind of like burn your esophagus, burn your larynx, right? So those people may have like hoarseness, they may have like wheezing, they may have like asthma-like symptoms, but it seems to get like really bad at night, and when they get up in the morning, you know, think about GERD under those circumstances, right? And in general, again, if a person has like the classic GERD symptoms, for the most part, go ahead and if they don't have alarm symptoms, go ahead and start them on a PPI. It's not a huge deal. You don't need to do EGD or whatever, right? But the thing is, if you've, and again, the alarm symptoms, like I said, being over the age of 50, right? Losing weight, right? If the person has GERD, actually with dysphagia. So I'll go ahead and say that again. If a person has GERD with dysphagia, right? So notice I talked about dysphagia early as a thing, right? In general, if a person has dysphagia, right? Like I said, for the most part, so I feel like I've bespoken a little earlier. So let me clear this up. Let me talk about dysphagia on its own, and let me talk about GERD, right? In general, if a person has dysphagia, the NBME will almost always give you some kind of alarm symptom or give you some kind of hook that leads you in one direction versus the other. Let me explain what I mean. Because the thing is, the algorithm for dysphagia is not as clear-cut as I would like it to be, right? So, and then I'll talk about GERD on its own, right? So if a person has like the old guy with dysphagia, has halitosis in the morning and all that badness, you know that Zenker's, right? Zenker's causes dysphagia, right? But you're not going to do an EGD for Zenker's diverticulum because an EGD is contraindicated in people with Zenkers. Why? Because you can perf through the diverticulum, and then you again have all these problems, right? So the thing you do with Zenkers is a barium swallow. The diagnosis is made with a barium swallow, right? But if a person has dysphagia and weight loss, right, or a person has dysphagia and like painful swallowing, right, then under those circumstances you'd want to consider getting an EGD, right? Now the area where they get tricky is a person that has GERD, and again GERD with alarm symptoms. So if a person has GERD and they have this any kind of dysphagia with it, like trouble swallowing of any sort, they're getting an EGD. If a person has GERD and they're anemic, right, their hemoglobin is low, right, they're getting an EGD. If a person has GERD and they're vomiting, they're getting an EGD. If a person has GERD and they're losing weight, they're getting an EGD. If a person has, like, GERD, and again, usually on MBM is this specific scenario, they make it like a prolonged kind of GERD, right? And they'll say, oh, they've tried like a PPI or anything and they haven't gotten better, right? If a person is over the age of 50, they are also getting an EGD. That's very, very important to keep at the back of your mind, right? So in general, if a person has classic GERD symptoms, just classic GERD symptoms and nothing else, go ahead and give those people a PPI. That's it. But in general, if you have GERD plus some other problem, you almost always will get an EGD for those people, right? So these different scenarios, I mean, because the thing is, it's kind of hard to make like one fail full profile, like fail safe algorithm, right? I would say like these scenarios I've mentioned will probably cover like 95% of what you could potentially see on your test, right? So again, if a person has GERD and you've given them PPIs, right, and the PPIs don't seem to be cutting it, right, then that's kind of a problem, right? So for those people, you want to go ahead and again perform an upper endoscopy, right? And the thing is, let's say you perform, I don't see them ever going this far, but the thing is, sometimes the family medicine shelf kind of goes too far on things, right? So the thing is, let's say you perform upper endoscopy and like the upper endoscopy is normal in a person that has GERD. Then one thing you can do as your next step is actually to do something called like a esophageal pH monitoring, right? So you can put a pH monitor. It's kind of uncomfortable for patients, to be honest, but you can put a pH monitor down the person's esophagus to kind of like, you know, whenever they have symptoms, the thing would, I think they will like press a button or something and it will record the pH in the esophagus. It's almost like the gold standard actually for making the diagnosis of GERD. So that's pretty much all I will say. Pretty much all I'll say about that. And again, for the most part, if a person has GERD, you treat with a PPI. And one thing I think I guess I forgot to say about achalasia is if you're treating achalasia, right, one thing you can do is you can do like a surgical myotomy, right? So you can do like a myotomy, and that essentially fixes the problem. Although, after people actually get the surgical myotomy for achalasia, it doesn't mean that they're not going to be placed on PPIs, right? They're very likely still going to be on PPIs for a while. So just something to keep in mind there. But that's more clinically relevant than maybe exam relevant. And then again, for GERD, like I said, you put those people on PPIs. And if GERD continues for long enough, right, like you're going to go into Barrett's esophagus, right? And again, one thing I want to do is, I guess, let me talk about a test-taking strategy here. It's just something that kind of fits nicely with this thing I want to discuss, right? Let's assume your friends at the MBME give you a question about a person that has esophageal adenocarcinoma, right? And then they say, which of the following historic factors is the biggest risk factor for esophageal adenocarcinoma in this patient? And let's say they put an answer that says GERD, and then let's say they put an answer that says Barrett's esophagus. Which answer should you pick on your test? Which answer should you pick on your test? I would really, really hope that you're picking, an answer that says Barrett's esophagus, right? The thing is GERD, right, leads to Barrett's esophagus. But think about it, between those two answers, GERD and Barrett's, which one has the most direct link to esophageal adenocarcinoma? That's going to be Barrett's esophagus, right? So the thing is, in general, on exams, whenever you have two very close conflicting answers, always pick the one that is the most directly related to the question at hand, okay? That's a very useful test-taking principle for the MBME exams, right? So again, just something to keep in mind. And the thing is, one screening guideline you may want to keep at the back of your mind with Barrett's esophagus is that basically if a person is like a guy and he's more than 50 years old and he has had GERD symptoms for like more than 5 years, And you know, let's say usually they'll make it like a pretty obvious question, right? It'll be like an old person, so it'll be a guy more than 50, not a woman, a guy more than 50, has GERD symptoms for like more than 5 years, and you know, let's say it's kind of like higher risk as well, you know, maybe drinks a ton of alcohol, you know, has all these metabolic syndrome antecedents, like he's obese, smokes, you know, like all the bad, all the bad symptoms that you kind of think about. Those people actually do need screening with an EGD for esophageal adenocarcinoma, right? So that's one of those weird screening guideline questions you may see on your test. And in general, if a person has like Barrett's esophagus, you typically do like a resection. You do like an endoscopic like resection or like an endoscopic ablation. In some cases, though, actually most times, those people also get pretty high dose PPIs, right? But the thing is, they will also, in general, need like, you know, like routine surveillance, usually every like 6 to 12 months. So I'll say like for the most part, like every like, just think of the 6 to 12 month period for the most part, and you should be fine with that. And in general, right, again, you don't screen women with GERD for Barrett's esophagus, right? And then remember the things that can, if for example, they give you a question about a person that has like odynophagia, right? And let's say this person has like HIV, right? You want to think about like candidal esophagitis, right? Candidal esophagitis. In fact, the thing is, if they give you an esophagitis question and they don't give you any hints, they don't tell you anything about the person having thrush on the mouth or anything, right? Because the NBME actually writes some of these questions where they give you like essentially no clues, no hints, nothing, right? And they expect you to just imagine, what's the cause of this person's esophagitis? Whenever you get those kinds of questions, to be perfectly honest with you, go ahead and pick Candida. Candida is the most common infectious cause of esophagitis, right? That's just like epidemiological thinking on the test, right? Just go with Candida. Candida is like the number one infectious cause. Number two is CMV. Number two is HSV. So just follow in alphabetical order, right? Like CA comes before CM and then C comes before H in the alphabet, right? And again, usually people that have candidal esophagitis, you know, they will have like thrush, but that's not always the case, right? I mean, like the NBME can write questions where a person has candidal esophagitis and they won't give you the classic thrush that you're expecting on your test, right? Also, don't forget like pili-induced esophagitis, right? Don't forget like your bisphosphonates. That's a classic one, especially like alendronate, right? Like that's why if you take bisphosphonates, you're supposed to like essentially be upright for like 30 minutes, right? So that you don't burn your esophagus. But there are some other classic things on NBMEs that tend to cause pili esophagitis. So things like your tetracyclines, like your ibuprofen, and other NSAIDs, like your potassium tablets, right? Iron tablets. Those things can cause all those problems, right? And for the most part, right, if a person has like esophageal candidiasis, you can treat them with like clotrimazole or Zengis or basically like any of those azole. So you can do like the nystatin swish and swallow, yada yada yada. That can work under those circumstances. And then if they give you a question about like a young person, so this is not going to be an old person's disorder on your test, like, you know, like a young person that has you know, like really bad heartburn, and this person is not necessarily obese, you'll be like, man, this person is pretty healthy, but this person has really bad heartburn and also has like many episodes where like it's almost like food is stuck in their esophagus. Whenever you see that, think about something called eosinophilic esophagitis. Okay, think about eosinophilic esophagitis. For the most part, these people, you give them PPIs, you'll be like, oh, this person has, you know, classic GERD symptoms. You give them PPIs for weeks, for like more than 2 months. And you're like, man, this person's symptoms don't seem to get better. And then you're like, you know what, let me go ahead and do an EGD. And then you do an EGD, you take a biopsy, and then you notice that there's a crap ton of eosinophils in that, right? That's eosinophilic esophagitis. For the most part, eosinophilic esophagitis responds to corticosteroid therapy. Responds pretty well to corticosteroids. And again, for candidal esophagitis, again, like I said, clotrimazole, lozenges, you can use fluconazole, you can use itraconazole, doesn't matter. You can use nystatin swish and swallow. If a person has herpes esophagitis, obviously you want to use acyclovir, or you can use like famciclovir. If it's CMV esophagitis, you want to use like ganciclovir, right? And again, remember, if you have like HSV or CMV resistant, or CMV esophagitis that's resistant to like acyclovir or ganciclovir, you can consider using You can consider using foscarinet. Remember, that's like that pyrophosphate analog. Pill esophagitis, you don't really need to do anything. You know, just tell the patient, you know, drink a ton of water while you're taking your meds. Basically, supportive care, they'll get better. And then if you get a question about a person that, you know, has like bloating symptoms, like burning, like there's burning, gnawing pain in the epigastrium. And, you know, they kind of feel full early and, you know, they just don't feel great, right? You want to think about like peptic ulcer disease, right? And for the most part, right, like the two big causes you want to think about are your tests, H. pylori, NSAIDs, right? And the thing is, if a person has any peptic ulcer disease symptoms, you need to test them for H. pylori, right? Even if they use NSAIDs, it doesn't matter. You're still going to test them for H. pylori, right? You're still going to test them for H. pylori. And again, remember that peptic ulcer disease can have problems, right? Like, what are some, like, I guess, classic complications your friends at the NBME could test, right? They could test the person that has, like, a long history of peptic ulcer disease, and then the person presents with, like, sudden onset severe abdominal pain, and then they show you an x-ray, you see free air under the under the diaphragm, right? Obviously, those people have perfed that ulcer, they've perfed the abdomen. Those people need exploratory laparotomy, like, yesterday, right? Another thing that can happen is those people can start having, like, really bad hemoptysis, especially like if it's like a duodenal ulcer that erodes and kind of like, you know, kind of like erodes the gastroduodenal artery. Those things can bleed and kill people, right? So for that, again, those people will need like very quick therapy so that they don't die, because that thing is actually pretty deadly. I've actually seen this like personally. And again, for the most part, right, if a person has H. pylori, you know, you test them for H. pylori. And after you test them, you know, you can treat them with like triple therapy. And the mnemonic for triple therapy is like CAP, right? So like clarithromycin, amoxicillin, and a PPI, right? Or you can pick quadruple therapy. That's like metronidazole, bismuth, tetracycline, and a PPI, right? So MBTP. That's the way I kind of remember that. And again, the thing is, again, if a person has peptic ulcer disease and they have alarm symptoms, you need to perform an EGD, right? Remember, an EGD, literally look at the name, esophagogastroduodenoscopy. It helps you evaluate the esophagus, the stomach, that's the gastro part of things, and the duodenum, right? So just something to keep at the back of your mind, right? And the thing is, in general, for H. pylori, right, you know, you can do like the urea breath test, or you can do like a stool antigen test, right? Essentially, the thing I will tell you is, do not pick like getting like antibodies to test for H. pylori, because it's not going to help you, like, because you have antibodies whether you've had like a past infection that you've cleared, or you have like a current infection, right? So the antibody test, you know, is usually not useful on NBME exams, right? And again, if a person has like peptic ulcer disease from like NSAIDs, you know, stop the NSAIDs. You know, you can treat them with like a H2 blocker, like ranitidine or whatever, right? Or you can treat them with like a PPI. That's pretty much all I'll say there. And then one other thing I would also say is, there's this thing that just came to my mind. Come on, Divine, think about this. If a person is going to be placed, this is a common NBME exam question. If a person is going to be placed on chronic like steroid therapy, right, for like some autoimmune disease or whatever, those people actually require two kinds of prophylaxis while they're on those steroids. They need to be on PPIs, right? Remember, PPIs can, because steroids can kind of like increase gastric acid production and cause like ulcers, right? Like gastric ulcers and duodenal ulcers, right? So those people need like chronic PPIs. And also, if you're on chronic corticosteroids, remember, steroids, right, can cause osteonecrosis. They can cause like an avascular necrosis of the hip. So typically for those people, they also need to be placed on bisphosphonates. So if you're on chronic corticosteroid therapy, okay, I'll just go ahead and say this right now. If you're on chronic corticosteroid therapy, you need to be placed on prophylactic PPIs and prophylactic bisphosphonates. Okay, that's very high yield to know for exams. And let's see, is there any other thing I want to say about peptic ulcer disease? To be honest, I think that's all I really want to say. And then what if they give you a question about like a diabetic, you know, having a lot of trouble, diabetic having a lot of trouble, like, you know, like feels bloated after meals, and, you know, feels nauseous after meals, feels full early, and all that badness, right? You want to think about gastroparesis, right? And remember, diabetes is not the only thing that can cause gastroparesis on an NBME, right? Because again, remember, your friends at the NBME, they're getting very creative these days, right? So what are some other things that can cause gastroparesis? Some other things that can cause gastroparesis are things like scleroderma, right? Hypothyroidism, believe it or not, can cause gastroparesis. If a person is on like chronic opioid therapy for like chronic pain or whatever, that can also cause gastroparesis, right? Or if a person is on like a chronic anticholinergic, let's say for whatever bizarre reason, a person is taking like daily like diphenhydramine, that can also cause gastroparesis, right? And in general, though, the most common gastroparetic thing you'll see on your NBME exams is from diabetes, right? And in terms of that, what do you do to treat diabetic gastroparesis? Essentially, what you do is you can treat it with a motiline receptor agonist, right? Like erythromycin, right? I mean, this is why macrolides cause diarrhea in the first place, right? Because you're essentially like increasing GI motility when you take a macrolide, right? So that's why diarrhea is actually one of their side effects. But that's more for step one or step three. I don't feel like that's something they will necessarily test on step two. So you can use an IV macrolide, usually it's erythromycin on your test, or you can also use a dopamine receptor antagonist like metoclopramide, right? But you can already maybe even begin to imagine what I'm going to say next, right? Your friends at the NBME, they can write a question about a person that, you know, was started on a drug for gastroparesis, and then this person is now having like tardive dyskinesia or having like bradykinesia or like a paucity of speech or like a resting tremor. If you see that, you want to think about like a drug-induced Parkinsonism, right? For the most part, you want to go ahead and stop the drug, right? Basically, whenever you're having side effects from a drug on an NBME, always find the answer that involves stopping the drug, right? If they've stopped the drug, then you can start treating or whatever, right? So it's just one of those rare things you want to keep at the back of your mind on tests. And then, what if they give you a question about a person that, you know, has had like weight loss surgery, or not even weight loss surgery, like some kind of, but usually it's weight, let me make this simple, some kind of weight loss surgery, you know, like a gastric bypass or whatever. And then they tell you that, this person, whenever the person eats, the person says that, I have like this crampy feeling in my belly, feel nauseous, having all these stools. And then like after that, like, you know, like an hour ish later, they tell you that they're kind of like sweating, feeling lightheaded, like all like tachycardic and whatever. If you see that, you want to think about dumping syndrome, right? You don't need to do any specific diagnostic test for that. It's something you diagnose clinically, right? You want to think about dumping syndrome. And for the most part, they may say, what's your best recommendation to the patient? Again, these are all things that the patients can come in for to family medicine, right? Typically, what you recommend for the patient is just say, you know, just take smaller meals more frequently, right? And in general, you want to take like low carb meals, right? So that you don't take a ton of meals that promote like hyperinsulinemia, right? So just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind, right? And then what if they give you a question about a patient? I feel like, because again, I don't want these podcasts to be like super, super long. So I suspect they will have to be like a final GI podcast. And again, my apologies, because there's just all these things that are kind of cropping up in my mind that I want to talk about that are kind of high yield for the shelf, right? So what if they give you a question about a patient that, you know, has like sudden onset, severe pain in the like epigastrium going to the back, and the person is like vomiting and, you know, has a high white count and all that crap. When you see that, what are you thinking about? Well, I hope you're thinking about a pancreatitis under those circumstances, right? And again, remember, there are many things that can cause pancreatitis. Alcoholism and gallstones are the most common, right? But if they tell you that, a person doesn't consume alcohol, then it's going to be gallstones, right? And the gallstone pancreatitic person on your test will be the person that's like obese. It'll almost certainly be a female that's like in her 40s or, you know, in reproductive age and stuff like that, right? So that's like the classic demographic, right, for pancreatitis on NBME exams, right? Although occasionally, right, they can give you a person that has like they can essentially integrate a question with like genetics, right? If a person has like one of those familial hyperlipidemias, especially like familial hypertriglyceridemia, especially when your triglyceride levels are more than 1,000, right, those things can trigger pancreatitis. And then again, do not forget the HIV drugs, stavudine and didanosine. Those are drugs they love to test on exams, right? And also valproic acid. Valproic acid loves to cause pancreatitis. Remember, valproic acid touches the liver and it touches the pancreas, okay? And or they can give you a question about a person that had like a recent ERCP, right? Or they can give you a question about a kid with pancreatitis. You know, you maybe want to think about, like, especially if it's a kid with Down syndrome, maybe annular pancreas as the cause. Or if it's a kid that's like fifth percentile for weight, recurrent respiratory infections with pancreatitis, you want to think about cystic fibrosis under those circumstances, right? Or if a person has like a very high calcium, right? Those things can all cause pancreatitis. And for the most part, pancreatitis, you can actually, basically there's three criteria. If you meet two out of these three criteria, you have your diagnosis, right? Like the classic, like severe abdominal pain, like in the epigastrium going to the back, right? That's like the classic abdominal pain pattern for pancreatitis. That's one. If your lipase, right, is more than 3-4 to the upper limit of normal, right? Or you have like imaging features, right? Like on a CT. CT is typically the imaging test you get in a person that has pancreatitis. But again, you usually do not need to order CT, right? But basically, if you have like two out of these three symptoms positive, right, that person has acute pancreatitis for the most part, right? That person has acute pancreatitis. And for the most part, you make those people MPO, you place them on pain control, and you give them copious amounts of IV fluids, usually normal saline, right? And one thing that your friends at the NDMA have actually started caring about is, what are some things that may tell you that, oh, this person may have pretty bad outcomes with their pancreatitis? Basically, you want to memorize the Ramsey's criteria. I'm not going to reel them off here to you. But basically, right, if those people have like a big drop in their hematocrit, or their calcium is super, super low, or they have like a very high white count, or the, I think like the, I know there's like EST criteria, I think if it's more than 250 or something like that, or if their LDH is really high, those are all like bad prognostic factors, right? Or if their BUN is like really high and it keeps going up. Again, if you see those kinds of things, you want to think about like bad features. So just go ahead and memorize those things. It's something you can look up, right? So just go ahead and look those things up. It will be really helpful. Trust me, it will be really helpful to you on a test. And remember that pancreatitis, the most common complication, again, this is one of those prognostic whatever questions you could get on a test, right? The most likely complication of acute pancreatitis is a pancreatic pseudocyst, okay? It's a pancreatic pseudocyst. And the thing is, if a person, you know, has had like many episodes of acute pancreatitis, and then they're beginning to give you questions about this person, like you know, having like fat malabsorption style symptoms, or they show you like a CT scan or like an abdominal x-ray, and you notice that you see like white around the pancreatic area, right? So that person essentially has chronic pancreatitis. Remember, those people need supplementation of pancreatic enzymes, and they also need supplementation of fat-soluble vitamins, right? So like vitamins A, D, E, and K, right? And again, in general, people that have pancreatitis do not require CT scans, okay? Because usually if they have the epigastric pain going to the back and they have like elevated lipase, remember lipase is more sensitive than amylase, that's all you need, right? They have pancreatitis, end of story, right? But if a person has like pancreatitis and you've treated them as you should, and you're like, man, it's more than 2 days, this person is not getting better, you can go ahead and get a CT scan under those circumstances. So, again, fluids, NPO, pain control, that's pretty much all I'll say about that. So I think I'm going to go ahead and let me maybe say one more thing about pancreatitis, and then I think I'll probably go ahead and stop here. The next GI podcast should hopefully be pretty quick and dirty. But basically, you want to think if they give you a question about a person, and you know this person has like an autoimmune history. So this person has a history of like hypothyroidism, aka Hashimoto's, or history of celiac disease, or history of Graves' disease, or history of vitiligo, or history of Addison's disease, right? Any autoimmune crap. And then this person has like recurrent episodes of epigastric pain going to the back. You want to think about autoimmune pancreatitis under those circumstances. And the thing is, autoimmune pancreatitis is one of those things that is one of those IgG4 related disorders. Again, I've said this in many of my rapid review podcasts. Those IgG4 related disorders are very high yield to know for tests, right? Like autoimmune pancreatitis, autoimmune cholecystitis, retroperitoneal fibrosis, right? Those are the kind of things you want to keep at the back of your mind for tests, right? And I mean, there's they may tell you that, oh, they get like a CT scan of the abdomen and they notice that the person's pancreas is shaped like a sausage. So a sausage-shaped pancreas, that's usually pathognomonic on MMA exams for autoimmune pancreatitis. And for the most part, you give those people corticosteroids and they'll be fine. So I'm going to go ahead and stop here. As I do at the end of every podcast, again, I do offer one-on-one tutoring for many exams. All the shelf exams I tutor for, so like family medicine, emergency medicine, IM, peds, gen surge, OB-GYN, neuro, psych, ICU shelf. Although I've never tutored anyone for the ICU shelf. Just no one has ever requested it, but actually can tutor you for the ICU shelf. And then step one, step two CK, step two CS, step three, preclinical med school exams. If you're a medicine resident and you need tutoring for the ABIM board exam, so the in-training exam, I do offer tutoring for all those things. And then, if you have a college body that needs tutoring in most of the pre-med subjects, so like Gen Chem, O Chem, Physics, Biochem, Histology, Physiology, I tutor for all those things. And then I also do these booster courses. It's 15 hours for Step 2 CK, Step 3. It's 20 hours for Step 1. Essentially, in those courses, I review like the must-knows, like the highest of the high yields in a case-based format for those exams. I kind of touch on all the different systems and all the different disciplines. And then starting next month, although I think I'll still make a podcast just on this, starting next month, I am going to, I think probably on a weekly basis, but I'll try out the first one. I'm going to be doing an online, I'm going to be doing like probably weekly online study groups. Basically it will be like 2 hours and it will have like a particular focus, right? So it could be like a cardiology study group or a gastroenterology study group, right? It will be attuned towards a specific USMLE exam, right? Although I'll probably also do this for medicine residents in the future, but essentially it will be something that will be held over Zoom. Okay. And it will be 2 hours long, and, each session will cost like $100 per participant. And but I plan to for sure do the first one starting the first week of next month. If I get enough interest from people, I mean, if I don't get enough interest, then I won't do it. I mean, move it to the second week or whatever. But if you're interested, send me an email and I'll add your name to a list. And then when the time comes, I will probably maybe a day or two to the end of this month, or, you know, latest by the first 2 days of next month, I'll give you some more details on how payments will be made. And obviously I'll just send you like a Zoom link. You click and get into the session. I will be very high yield in general. I'll have like a ton of questions that I bring in that we work on, right? But in general, it will be like a nice way. Let's say, for example, you're struggling with like cardiology, right? Then, you know, you just go ahead and attend the study group. Let's say you're studying with cardiology for step one or cardiology for step two CK or for step three. We'll essentially fix those problems relatively quickly in that 2 hour time frame. I'll probably be able to take a few questions. I won't necessarily be able to take like copious amounts of questions since it's going to be like strictly 2 hours. But if it's something you're interested in and you want your name to be added to the list, because obviously I can't take unlimited numbers of people, just go ahead and reach out to me. If there's a topic you're particularly interested in, like cardiology for step one or neurology for step one or something like that, go ahead and indicate that in the email that you send to me. Again, you can send these emails out to me either through the website, or you can send me an email specifically through, and this is probably my preferred method, Divine Intervention Podcasts with an S at the end. So DIVINTERVENTIONPODCASTS@gmail.com. Right? So you can send me an email that way, right? Just tell me like, Divine, I'm interested in your private study group that's going to be through Zoom. So just reach out through me through any of those mediums, indicate what you want. And I misspoke earlier. I said the first week of February. I'm starting the second week in February, right? But again, if you're interested, just reach out to me. And then I also do like one-on-one coaching, right? So like if you're a med student applying to residency, so like an ERAS application, or a college student applying to med school, so like an AMCAS application, I do offer like one-on-one like coaching with like rec letters, personal statement editing, editing applications, mock interviews. And I do this by specialty, right? Because again, I've worked with tons of people from multiple specialties. And again, I also have like one-on-one admissions committee experience at a top two med school for like a year. So again, I'm pretty good at working with applications. And the vast majority of people I've worked with have all matched at their first choice, right? So if that's something you're interested in, feel free to reach out to me. And please, like I said, if you could subscribe to the YouTube channel, that'd be really helpful. It's called Divine Intervention Podcasts and Videos. You can subscribe to my WordPress website. I have these podcasts on like Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, on Spotify. So please subscribe to the podcast. And any feedback or anything is certainly very helpful. So have a wonderful rest of your day. I'll see you in the next podcast, which hopefully should be coming around very soon. Thank you and God bless you.